with all the news this week of fires in San Diego, it's pushed another big story off the front page, which is Iraq. Every Friday on the BPP, we sum up the major events that happen in, around, and about the conflict in Iraq through the week, and we call it The Week in Iraq. I love that. Iraq was at the center of a couple of big conflicts this week, one with neighboring Turkey because of ongoing threats to that country by Kurdish guerrillas in northern Iraq, and another one between the U.S. and Iran. Yesterday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, as you heard earlier in the program, announced sanctions against the Iranian government's armed forces for allegedly supporting terrorism and spreading weapons of mass destruction into Iraq. Our own newscaster, Rachel Martin, and foreign correspondent extraordinaire, is here to talk us through this all and what it means. Rachel, it seems like only 3-4 years ago, President Bush was talking about, oh, sanctions don't work. That's why we need to invade Iraq. And here we go back to sanctions.
Yeah, it's a little deja vu.
Yeah. So what kind of impact are they expected to make, especially sanctions against an armed forces? I don't understand this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, it's important to take note of the fact that this is not the first time that the U.S. has put sanctions on Iran. This is not new. Iran has been designated a state sponsor of terrorism by the United States since 1984, a few years after the hostage crisis. So the U.S. has no trade with Iran. This is ramping up of some serious rhetoric with a few more teeth. I mean, it's not going to not do anything. It's affecting three of the biggest banks in Iran, freezing those assets, and they're taking a swipe at the armed forces, the Revolutionary Guard and the elite force called the Quds Force. The U.S. is accusing these organizations of spreading weapons of mass destruction. This is not light language. This is heavy stuff.
Yeah, but it's not like these armed forces were shopping at Crate and Barrel or something in the United States in terms of sanctions.
It's true. But the intent is to try to also persuade other countries that do business with these organizations to clamp down on the relations. China and Russia, both of those have strong relationships in Iran. And so all of this is to lay the foundation to say, hey, we're cutting off whatever remaining ties we had with Iran. We're severing them right now. And we hope that the heavy hitters in the world who are still maintaining business connections with Iran will follow suit.
Okay, I get it. So why now? Has this been in the offing for a while?
Well, this is being connected to Iraq in some ways. But let's go back a little bit. The justification for the sanctions are that the Quds Force and the Revolutionary Guard have been supporting terrorist groups, not just in Iraq, but in the Palestinian territories, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and allegedly the Taliban in Afghanistan. And so the U.S. is painting this as with a much broader stroke, saying that these organizations are dangerous, they're a threat to global security. And in Iraq specifically, they have been financing Shiite militias that then turn around and use this weaponry to attack U.S. forces. And this is language, and this is a message that's been delivered by U.S. military officials in Iraq for months and months and months. I was in Baghdad this summer. Every time you turned around, it felt like there was another press conference where people were talking about Iran's involvement in Iraq. And General Petraeus made this a key part of his testimony to Congress just this last fall. Here's a little bit of what he said.
It is increasingly apparent to both coalition and Iraqi leaders that Iran, through the use of the Iranian Republican Guard Corps Quds Force, seeks to turn the Shia militia extremists into a Hezbollah-like force to serve its interests and fight a proxy war against the Iraqi state.
So this is not new. This is language. These are accusations that have been around for a while.
Okay, well, let's move from Iran, Iraq's eastern neighbor, to Turkey, which is on Iraq's northern border. What's the latest with the standoff between Turkey and Kurdish guerrillas in northern Iraq?
Well, the tension is still ramping up. There's been a flurry of phone calls. A top-level official been flying back and forth from Baghdad to Turkey to try to avert military action by Turkey. The problem is this. There are Kurdish guerrillas in the north of Iraq that are staging attacks on Turkey from up in those mountains. And Turkey has been sitting back saying, listen, United States and Iraq, you've promised to do something about this. Step up and make it happen. And they're losing patience, basically. Even this week, Turkey was flying some aircraft along the border, doing some strategic shelling to kind of show their teeth a little bit, to say, we're running out of time and you need to do something. As we mentioned earlier in the show, the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad is stepping up pressure on Iraq, and U.S. officials for the first time are putting a heavy hand on Kurds, saying to Kurdish officials in northern Iraq, you got to do something to make this stop because we can't risk losing an alliance with Turkey.
And that was the week that was in Iraq and its neighbors, I should say.
Indeed.
Our own Rachel Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, we've talked a lot about, when we talk about Iraq, how American media covers various issues, everything from what happens on the ground to security. But from the Iraqi point of view, what is the security situation? Well, if you watch this week's episode of Alive in Baghdad, you might know. Alive in Baghdad is a weekly series about how the war affects the people living in Iraq, and it's covered by Iraqis. In this week's episode, this music swells as the camera pushes into the exterior of a hospital to see a day in the life of Facility Protection Services. They guard the health ministry, but also they find themselves assisting in treatment. Here's a youngish guard dressed in standard security uniform up top, gray fatigues on the bottom, describing the scene at the hospital after an explosion. Now, what he's saying is after an explosion, that the security is divided into three groups, one to protect cars and people entering, one to frisk people, and one to assist the staff, including maybe mixing medicines and the like. I know that because there are English subtitles over every episode. Brian Conley is a documentary filmmaker and the founder of Alive in Baghdad. He joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. So who are the journalists reporting stories like this and all the stories for Alive in Baghdad?
Well, it's a variety of Iraqi staff members. For example, Nabil Kamal, who did that story, has been working in various jobs in Iraqi television for about 10 years. Then we have another guy who's sort of been around longer, Issam Rashid, who was an engineer prior to the war. When the war started, he got a job as a translator and fixer with some different UK media outlets. And then after that, he sort of said, well, you know, this is what I need to do with my life, and basically changed his entire life and, you know, quit what could have been a very lucrative career as an engineer to basically, you know, document what's going on in Iraq and try to tell stories about life in Baghdad.
So when you work with some of these people who perhaps aren't trained in traditional journalism, what kind of things do you have to teach them and explain to them about covering a story on the ground?
Well, I think it's more than anything, we've really tried to now move in a direction where pretty much all of our staff have two or more years as journalists. But I think it's more important that we are teaching them, you know, the specifics about producing video for the web, which, you know, it's usually a very small picture and things like that. But then also looking at the way we do stories in the U.S. You know, we talk about, you know, you need to have 3 to 5 interviews per piece minimum. We talk a little bit about having voices from different sides, or, you know, creating a story that's like clearly about one subject and that maybe it's one angle or it's one perspective, you know, things like this. And it's just one of those things you just sort of are dealing with, like cultural differences about how things are done. I mean, there's, you know, dozens of TV stations in Iraq now, but that's because each political party has a TV station, each religious group has a TV station. So it's very different from, you know, what we'd expect from television here in the U.S.
Now, can you give me a couple of examples of stories that you covered on Alive in Baghdad that probably never would have made it into the mainstream news coverage of what the conflict in Iraq?
Sure. I mean, there's, you know, all kinds of things. A couple months back, we did a two-part story about the Al-Walid refugee camp, which is a camp in the desert between Syria and Iraq, and what's sort of referred to as kind of like the no man's land, which is a sort of almost neutral zone border area. And I don't believe any Western press has been inside the camp. And we went in and interviewed probably a half a dozen or a dozen different refugees, showed what it was like for people there. You know, and then recently we did a story about a small child whose mother basically died protecting her from a car bombing. And, you know, about her face was horribly scarred, and she's, you know, they think she's probably going to be blind for the rest of her life. And we're just talking with her family members about, you know, the aftermath and what it was like. Because, you know, we usually see the death toll, you know, and we hear these numbers. But when we hear a number like 250 wounded, we rarely understand what that really means. You know, even for the U.S. military, who have, you know, heavy armor and, you know, protection and some of the best, you know, healthcare money can buy in battlefield medicine. But then in terms of the Iraqis, you know, we rarely see that.
So that is really the service. That's one of the services you provide. That's one of the reasons you exist, is to try to give this other side of a story.
Exactly. Just to sort of to add another insight, you know, and to speak to the Iraqis at the ground level, which, you know, we hear the rest of the media sort of saying it's too dangerous to cover this story, or it's not possible, or we don't have the context. So that's where we come in, and that's what we're trying to do.
And your funding is not going so well, correct? You're running out of cash, to be frank?
Yeah, exactly. Basically, we had we raised about half the money that our minimum cost just for Iraq, not including, you know, myself or my partner and editor Steve Wishwanek. It's interesting. I mean, we've had our best sort of funding has come from licensing some of our content to the UK media outlets, Sky News, and then also BBC Newsnight.
Brian Conley is a documentary filmmaker and the founder of Alive in Baghdad. Good luck with keeping it going, Brian.
Sure. Thank you so much.